standing, knocking her chair back. "Regret is not a word I would use for endangering the world itself, bringing us to the brink of darkness and all but shoving us over the edge. She had copies of that device made, woman. One ended up around the neck of the Dragon Reborn. The Dragon Reborn himself, controlled by one of the Forsaken." Nynaeve flung her hands into the air. "Light! We were heartbeats from the end, because of you. The end of everything. No more pattern, no more world, nothing. Millions of lives could have winked out because of your carelessness." Lyelwyn's failure seemed monumental suddenly. Her life lost. Her very name lost. Her ship, stripped from her by the Daughter of the Nine Moons herself. All were immaterial in light of this.
"I did fight," Bale said more firmly. "I did fight with what I could give."
"I should have joined you, it appears," Lyelwyn said.
"I did try to explain that," Bale said grimly. "Many times now, burn me, but I did."
"Bah," Nynaeve said, raising a hand to her forehead. "What are you doing here, Egeenan? I had hoped you were dead. If you had died trying to keep your oath, then I could not have blamed you." "I handed it to Suroth myself," Lyelwyn thought. "A price paid for my life. The only way out."
"Well?" Nynaeve glared at her. "Out with it, Egeenan."
"I no longer bear that name." Lyelwyn went down on her knees. "I have had all stripped from me, including my honor, it now appears. I give myself to you as payment."
Nynaeve snorted. "We don't keep people as if they were animals, unlike you, Seanchan."
Lyelwyn continued kneeling. Bale rested a hand on her shoulder but did not try to pull her to her feet. He understood well enough now why she had to do as she had. He was quite nearly civilized.
"On your feet," Nynaeve snapped. "Light, Egeenan. I remember you being so strong you could chew rocks and spit out sand."
"It is my strength that compels me," she said, lowering her eyes. Did Nynaeve not understand how difficult this was? It would be easier to slit her own throat. Only she had not the honor left to demand such an easy end.
"Stand."
Lyelwyn did as told. Nynaeve grabbed her cloak off the bed and threw it on.
"Come. We'll take you to the Ammerlin. Maybe she'll know what to do with you."
Nynaeve barged out into the night, and Lyelwyn followed. Her decision had been made. There was only one path that made sense, one way to preserve a shred of honor, and perhaps to help her people survive the lies they had been telling themselves for so long. Lyelwyn shipless now belonged to the White Tower. Whatever they said, whatever they tried to do with her, that fact would not change. They owned her. She would be a Dakovale to this Ammerlin, and would ride this storm like a ship whose sail had been shredded by the wind. Perhaps, with what remained of her honor, she could earn this woman's trust.
"It's part of an old Borderlander relief for the pain," Milton said, removing the bandage at Talmanis's side. "The blister leaf slows the taint left by the cursed metal." Milton was a lean, mop-haired man. He was dressed like an Andoran woodsman with a simple shirt and cloak, but he spoke like a Borderlander. In his pouch he carried a set of colored balls that he'd sometimes juggle for the other members of the band. In another life, he must have been a gleeman. He was an unlikely man to be in the band, but they all were, in one way or another. "I don't know how it dampens the poison," Milton said, "but it does. It's no natural poison, mind you. You can't suck it free." Talmanis pressed his hand to the side. The burning pain felt like thorny vines crawling in under his skin, creeping forward and tearing at his flesh with every movement. He could feel the poison moving through his body. light, but it hurt. Nearby, the men of the band fought through Camlin up toward the palace. They'd come in through the southern gate, leaving the mercenary bands, under Sandeep's command, holding the western gate. If there was human resistance anywhere in the city, it would be at the palace. Unfortunately, fists of Trollocs roved the area between Talmanis's position and the palace. They kept running across the monsters and getting drawn into fights. Talmanis couldn't find out if, indeed, there was resistance above without getting there. That meant leading his men up toward the palace, fighting all the way, and leaving himself open to being cut off from behind if one of those roving groups worked around behind him. There was nothing for it, though. He needed to find out what, if anything, remained of the palace defenses. From there he could strike further into the city and try to get the dragons. The air smelled of smoke and blood. During a brief pause in the fighting, they'd piled dead Trollocs against the right side of the street to make room for passage. There were refugees in this quarter of the city, too, though not a flood of them. A stream, maybe, seeping in from the darkness as Talmanis and the band seized sections of the thoroughfare leading up toward the palace. These refugees never demanded that the band protect their goods or rescue their homes. They sobbed with joy at finding human resistance. Madwin was in charge of sending them toward freedom along the corridor of safety the band had carved free. Talmanis turned up toward the palace atop the hill, but only barely visible in the night. Though most of the city burned, the palace was not aflame. Its white walls hung in the smoky night like phantoms. No fire. That had to indicate resistance, didn't it? Wouldn't the Trollocs have attacked it as one of their first actions in the city? He'd sent scouts along the street up ahead as he gave his men, and himself, a short breather. Milton finished tying Talmanis's poultice tight.
"Thank you, Milton," Talmanis said, nodding to the man. "I can feel the poultice working already. You said this is part of the cure for the pain. What is the other part?"
Melton unhooked a metal flask from his belt and handed it over.
"Shinaran brandy. Full strength. It's not a good idea to drink in combat, man."
"Take it," Melton said softly. "Keep the flask and drink it deep, my lord. Or come the next bell, you won't be standing."
Talmanis hesitated, then took the flask and took a long swallow. It burned like the wound. He coughed, then tucked the brandy away.
"Take it," Melton said softly. "Keep the flask and drink it deep, my lord. Or come the next bell, you won't be standing."
Talmanis hesitated, then took the flask and took a long swallow. It burned like the wound. He coughed, then tucked the brandy away.
"I believe you mistook your bottles, Melton. That was something you found in a tanning vat."
Melton snorted.
"And it's said you have no sense of humor, Lord Talmanis." "I haven't one," Talmanis said. "Stay close with that sword of yours."
Melton nodded, eyes solemn.
"Dreadbane," he whispered.
"What's that?"
"Borderlander title. You slew a fade. Dreadbane. It had about 17 bolts in it at the time." "Doesn't matter."
Melton clasped him on the shoulder.
"Dreadbane. When you can't take the pain any longer, make two fists and raise them toward me. I will see the deed done."
Talmanis stood up, unable to suppress a groan. They both understood. The several borderlanders in the band agreed. Wounds taken by a Thakandar blade were unpredictable. Some festered fast, others made men sick. When one went black like Talmanis's, though, that was the worst. Nothing short of finding an Aes Sedai in the next few hours could save him.
"See," Talmanis muttered, "it is a good thing I have no sense of humor. Otherwise I should think the pattern was playing a joke on me."
"Denel, you have a map handy?"
"Light, but he missed Bannon."
"My lord,"
Denel said, hurrying across the dark street carrying a torch and a hastily drawn map. He was one of the band's dragon captains.
I think we've found a faster way through the streets to where Aludra had the dragons stored.
We're fighting to the palace first, Talmonis said.
My lord.
Denil's words came more softly from his wide lips. He was picking at his uniform as if it didn't fit right.
If the shadow reaches those dragons...
I'm well aware of the dangers, Denil, thank you. How fast could you move the things, assuming we reach them? I'm worried about extending ourselves too far, and this city is going up faster than oil-soaked love letters to a High Lord's mistress. I want to get the weapons and leave the city as quickly as possible. I can level an enemy bulwark in a shot or two, my lord, but the dragons do not move quickly. They are attached to carts, so that will help, but they aren't going to be any faster than, say, a line of supply wagons, and they would take time to set up properly and fire.
Then we continue to the palace, Talmonis said.
But
at the palace, he said sternly, we might find women who can channel us a gateway straight to Aludra's warehouse. Besides, if we find the palace guard still fighting, we know we have a friend at our backs. We will retrieve those dragons, but we'll do it smartly.
He noticed Ladwin and Mar hurriedly coming down from above.
There are Trollocs up there, Mar said, hastening up to Talmonis. 100 strong at least, hunkered down in the street. Form ranks, men, Talmonis shouted. We push for the palace.
The sweat tent fell completely still. Avienda had anticipated incredulity, perhaps, at her tale. Questions, certainly. Not this painful silence. Though she had not expected it, she did understand it. She had felt it herself after seeing her vision of the Aiel slowly losing Je'eto in the future. She had witnessed the death, dishonor, and ruination of her people. At least now she had someone with whom to share that burden. The heated stones in the kettle hissed softly. Someone should pour more water, but none of the room's 6 occupants moved to tend it. The other 5 were all wise ones, naked, as was Avienda, after the manner of sweat tents. Sorelia, Amis, Bear, Milane, and Chimer of the Tomanella Aiel. All stared straight ahead, each alone for the moment with her thoughts. One by one they straightened their backs and sat up, as if accepting a new burden. That comforted Avienda. Not that she'd expected the news to break them. It was still good to see them set their faces toward the danger, instead of away from it. Sight blinder is too close to the world now, said Milane. The pattern has been twisted somehow. In the dream we still see many things that may or may not happen, but there are too many possibilities. We cannot tell one from another. The fate of our people is unclear to the dreamwalkers, as is the fate of the Karakarn once he spits in Sight Blinder's eye on the last day. We do not know the truth of what Avienda saw. We must test this, Sorelia said, eyes like stone. We must know. Is each woman now shown this vision instead of the other? Or was the experience unique? Eleanor of the Darain, Amis said. Her training is nearly complete. She will be the next to visit Ruidian. We could ask Haida and Shani to encourage her. Avienda suppressed a shudder. She understood too well how encouraging the wise ones could be. That would be well, Bear said, leaning forward. Perhaps this is what happens whenever someone goes through the glass columns a second time. Maybe that is why it is forbidden. None of them looked at Avienda, but she could feel them considering her. What she had done was forbidden. Speaking of what happened in Ruidian was taboo also. There would be no reprimand. Ruidian had not killed her. This was what the wheel had spun. Bear continued to stare into the distance. Sweat trickled down the sides of Avienda's face and her breasts. "I do not miss taking baths," she told herself. She was no soft wetlander. Still, a sweat tent wasn't truly necessary on this side of the mountains. There was no bitter cold at night, so the heat of the tent felt stifling, not comforting. And if water was plentiful enough for bathing, no. She set her jaw. "May I speak?" "Don't be foolish, girl," Milane said. The woman was round in the belly, nearly to term. "You're one of us now. No need to ask permission." "Girl?" It would take time for them to see her truly as one of them. But they did make an effort. Nobody ordered her to make tea or to throw water on the kettle. With no apprentice around and no Guy Shine handy, they took turns doing these tasks. "I am less concerned with whether the vision repeats," Avienda said, "than with what I was shown. Will it happen? Can we stop it?" "Ruidian shows two types of vision," Keimer said. She was a younger woman, perhaps less than a decade Avienda's senior, with deep red hair and a long, tanned face. "The first visit is what could be, the second, to the columns, what has happened." "This third vision could be either," Amis said. "The columns always show the past accurately. Why would they not show the future with equal accuracy?" Avienda's heart lurched. "But why?" Bear said softly. "Would the columns show a despair that cannot change?" "No. I refuse to believe it. Ruidian has always shown us what we needed to see. To help us, not destroy us. This vision must have a purpose as well. To encourage us toward greater honor?" "It's unimportant," Cerulea said curtly. "But," Avienda began. "It's unimportant," Cerulea repeated. "If this vision were unchangeable, if our destiny is to fall, as you have spoken, would any of us stop fighting to change it?" The room grew still. Avienda shook her head. "We must treat it as if it can be changed," Cerulea said. "Best not to dwell on your question, Avienda. We must decide what course to take." Avienda found herself nodding. Yes. Yes, you are correct, wise one." "But what do we do?" Keimer asked. "What do we change? For now the last battle must be won." "Almost," Amis said. "I wish for the vision to be unchangeable. For at least it proves we win this fight." "It proves nothing," Cerulea said. "Sightblinder's victory would break the pattern, and so no vision of the future can be sure or trusted. Even with prophecies of what might happen in ages to come, if Sightblinder wins this battle, all will become nothing." "This vision I saw has to do with whatever Rand is planning," Avienda said. They turned to her. "Tomorrow," she said. "From what you've told me, he's preparing for an important revelation." "The Kara Karn has a fondness for dramatic presentations," Bear said, her tone itself fond. "He's like a crocodile who has toiled all night making a nest so that he can sing of it in the morning to all who will listen." Avienda had been surprised to discover the gathering at Merilor. She had found it only by using her bond to Randall Thor to determine where he was. Arriving here to find so many together, the wetlander forces collected, she wondered if this was part of what she'd seen. Was this gathering the start of what would become her vision? "I feel as if I know more than I should," she spoke almost to herself. "You have had a deep glimpse of what the future may hold, Keimer said. It will change you, Avienda. Tomorrow is key, Avienda said. His plan. From what you said, Keimer replied, it sounds as if he intends to ignore the Aiel, his own people. Why would he give boons to everyone else but not to those who are most deserving? Does he seek to insult us? I don't think that is the reason, Avienda said. I think he intends to make demands of those who attend, not grant them gifts. He did mention a price, Bear said. A price he intends to make the others pay. Nobody has been able to pry the secret of this price from him. He went through a gateway to Tyr earlier this evening and returned with something, Milane said. The maidens report it. He keeps his oath to bring them with him now. When we have inquired after his price, he has said that it is something that the Aiel need not worry about. Avienda scowled. He is making men pay him in order to do what we all know he must. Perhaps he has been spending too much time with that minder the sea folk sent him. No, this is well, Amis said. These people demand much of the Karakarn. He has a right to demand something of them in return. They are soft. Perhaps he intends to make them hard. And so he leaves us out, Bear said softly, because he knows that we are already hard. The tent fell silent. Amis, looking troubled, ladled some water onto the kettle's heated stones. It hissed as the steam rose. That is it, Sorilea said. He does not intend to insult us. He intends to do us honor in his own eyes. She shook her head. He should know better. Often, Keimer agreed. The Karakarn gives insult by accident, as if he were a child. We are strong, so his demand, whatever it is, matters not. If it is a price the others can pay, so can we. He would not make these mistakes if he had been trained properly in our ways, Cerulea murmured. Avienda met their eyes evenly. No, she had not trained him as well as he could have been trained, but they knew that Randall Thor was obstinate. Besides, she was their equal now. Although she had trouble feeling that way while facing Sorilea's tight-lipped disapproval. Perhaps it was spending so much time with wetlanders like Elaine, but suddenly she did see things as Rand must. To give the Aiel an exemption from his price, if indeed that was what he intended, was an act of honor. If he had made a demand of them with the others, these very wise ones might have taken offense at being lumped with the wetlanders. What was he planning? She saw hints of it in the visions, but increasingly she was certain that the next day would start the Aiel on the road to their doom. She must see that did not happen. This was her first task as a wise one, and would likely be the most important she was ever given. She would not fail. Her task was not just to teach him, Amis said. What I wouldn't give to know that he was safely under the watchful eyes of a good woman. She looked at Avienda, face laden with meaning. He will be mine, Avienda said firmly. But not for you, Amis, or for our people. She was shocked at the strength of that sentiment within her. She was Aiel. Her people meant everything to her. But this choice was not their choice. This choice was hers. Be warned, Avienda, Bear said, laying a hand on her wrist. He has changed since you left. He has grown strong. Avienda frowned. In what way? He has embraced death, Amis said, sounding proud. He may still carry a sword and wear the clothing of a wetlander, but he is ours now. Finally and truly. I must see this, Avienda said, standing. I will discover what I can regarding his plans. There is not much time remaining, Keimer warned. One night remains, Avienda said. It will be enough. The others nodded, and Avienda started to dress. Unexpectedly, the others joined her, dressing as well. It appeared that they considered her news important enough that they would be going to share it with the other wise ones, rather than continuing to sit in conference. Avienda was the first to step out into the night. The cool air, away from the sweltering heat of the sweat tent, felt good on her skin. She took a deep breath. Her mind was heavy with fatigue, but sleep would need to wait. The tent flaps rustled behind the other wise ones, Milane and Ami speaking softly to one another as they hastened into the night. Keimer walked purposefully toward the Tominella section of the camp. Perhaps she would speak with her uncle, Han, the Tominella chief. Avienda started to move off herself, but a bony hand took her arm. She glanced over her shoulder to see Bear standing behind her, dressed again in blouse and skirt. Wise one, Avienda said by reflex. Wise one, Bear replied with a smile. Is there something? I would go to Ruidian, Bear said, glancing at the sky. Would you kindly make for me a gateway? You're going through the glass columns. One of us needs to. Despite what Keimer said, Eleanor is not ready, particularly not to see something of this nature. That girl spends half of her days squawking like a buzzard over the last scrap of a rotting carcass. But, oh, don't you start to. You're one of us now, Avienda, but I'm still old enough to have tended your great mother when she was a child. Bear shook her head. Her white hair almost seemed to glow in the filtered moonlight. I am the best one to go, she continued. Channelers must be preserved for the battle to come. I would not have some child walk into those columns now. I will do it. Now, that gateway? Will you grant my request, or do I need to bully Amis into doing so? Avienda would have liked to see anyone bully Amis into anything. Maybe Soralia could do it. She said nothing, however, and created the proper weave to open a gateway. The thought of another seeing what she'd seen made her stomach twist. What would it mean if Bear returned with the exact same vision? Would that imply the future was more likely? It was that terrible, was it? Bear asked softly. Horrible. It would have made spears weep and stones crumble, Bear. I would rather have danced with Sightblinder himself. Then it is much better that I go than another. It should be the strongest of us who does this. Avienda stopped herself from raising an eyebrow. Bear was as tough as good leather, but the other wise ones weren't exactly flower petals. Bear, Avienda said, a thought occurring to her. Have you ever met a woman named Nakomi? Nakomi. Bear tried the word in her mouth. An ancient name. I have never known anyone who uses it. Why? I met an Aiel woman while traveling to Ruidian, Avienda said. She claimed not to be a wise one, but she had a way about her. She shook her head. The question was merely idle curiosity. Well, we shall know some of the truth of these visions, Bear said, stepping toward the gateway. What if they are true, Bear? Avienda found herself asking. What if there isn't anything we can do? Bear turned. You saw your children, you said. Avienda nodded. She hadn't spoken in detail of that segment of the vision. It had seemed more personal to her. Change one of their names, Bear said. never speak of the name that child was called in the vision, not even to us. Then you shall know. If one thing is different, then others may be different as well. Will be different. This is not our fate, Avienda. It is a path we will avoid together. Avienda found herself nodding. Yes, a simple change, a small change, but full of meaning. Thank you, Bear. The aging wise one nodded to her, then stepped through the gateway, running in the night toward the city ahead.
Talmanis threw his shoulder against a hulking boar-faced trollic in crude chain armor. The beast smelled horrid, like smoke, wet fur, and unwashed flesh. It grunted at the force of Talmanis's assault. The things always seemed surprised when he attacked them. Talmanis pulled back, ripping his sword out of the beast's side as it collapsed. He then lunged forward and rammed his sword into its throat, heedless of its ragged fingernails scratching at his legs. Life faded from the beady, too human eyes. Men fought, called, grunted, killed. The street ran up a steep incline toward the palace. Trolloc hordes had entrenched here, holding position and keeping the band from reaching the top. Talmanis sagged against the side of a building. The one next to it was on fire, lighting the street with violent colors and bathing him in heat. Those fires seemed chilly compared to the flaring, horrible pain of his wound. The flare ran down his leg to his foot and was beginning to work its way across his shoulder. Blood and bloody ashes, he thought. What I'd give for another few hours with my pipe and book, alone and peaceful. The people who spoke of glorious death in battle were complete flaming fools. There was nothing glorious about dying in this mess of fire and blood. Give him a quiet death any day. Talmanis pushed himself back up to his feet, drops of sweat falling from his face. Below, Trollocs amassed themselves behind his rear position. They had closed the road behind Talmanis's force, but Talmanis was able to proceed, cutting through the Trollocs ahead. Retreat would be difficult to pull off. As well as this roadway being full of Trollocs, fighting in the city meant that Trollocs could wind through the streets in small groups and attack his flanks as they advanced and later when they retreated.
"Throw everything you've got at them, men!"
he bellowed, hurling himself up the street and into the Trollocs blocking the way up. The palace was quite close now. He caught a goat-faced Trolloc's sword on his shield right before it would have taken off Denil's head. Talmanis tried to shove the beast's weapon back, but light Trollocs were strong. Talmanis barely kept this one from throwing him to the ground as Denil recovered and attacked its thighs, bringing it down. Melton fell in beside Talmanis. The Borderlander was true to his word to stay close, in case Talmanis needed a sword to end his life. The two led the push up the hill. The Trollocs began to give, then rallied, a snarling, roaring heap of dark fur, eyes and weapons in the firelight. There were so many of them.
"Steady!"
Talmanis yelled.
"For Lord Matt and the Band of the Red Hand!"
If Matt were here, he would probably curse a lot, complain as much, then proceed to save them all with some battlefield miracle. Talmanis couldn't reproduce Matt's blend of insanity and inspiration, but his yell did seem to encourage the men. The ranks tightened. Gavid arrayed his 24 crossbowmen, the last Talmanis had with him, atop a building that hadn't burned away. They started driving flight after flight of bolts into the Trollocs. That might have broken human enemies, but not Trollocs. The bolts dropped a few, but not as many as Talmanis would have hoped. "There's another fade back there," Talmanis thought, pushing them forward. "Light, I can't fight another. I shouldn't have fought the one I did." He shouldn't be on his feet. Melton's flask of brandy was gone, long since drained to deaden what it could. His mind was already as fuzzy as he dared allow. He fell in with Denil and Landrade at the front, fighting, concentrating, letting Trolloc blood out onto the cobbles to stream down the hillside. The band gave a good fight of it, but they were outnumbered and exhausted. Down below, another Trolloc fist joined the ones on the street behind him. That was it. He would have to either hit that force behind, turning his back on the one in front, or break his men into smaller units and send them retreating through side streets to regroup at the gate below. Talmanis prepared to give the orders.
"Forward, the White Lion!" voices yelled. "For Andor and the Queen!"
Talmanis spun as men in white and red broke through the Trolloc lines atop the hill. A second force of Andorran pikemen poured out of a side alleyway, coming in behind the Trolloc horde that had just surrounded him. The Trollocs broke before the oncoming pikemen, and in moments the entire mass, like a pus-filled blister, burst, Trollocs scattering in all directions. Talmanis stumbled back. Momentarily he had to prop himself up with his sword as Matwin took command of the counterstrike, and his men killed many of the fleeing Trollocs. A group of officers in bloodied Queen's Guard uniforms rushed down the hillside. They didn't look any better than the band. Gaibon led them.
"Mercenary," he said to Talmanis, "I thank you for showing up."
Talmanis frowned. "You act as if we saved you. From my perspective, it happened the other way around." Gaibon grimaced in the firelight.
"You gave us some respite. Those Trollocs were attacking the palace gates. I apologize for taking so long to reach you. We didn't realize at first what had drawn them in this direction."
"Right. The palace still stands?"
"Yes," Gaibon said. "We're full of refugees, though."
"What of channelers?" Talmanis asked, hopeful.
"Why haven't the Andorran armies returned with the Queen?"
"Dark friends," Gaibon frowned. "Her Majesty took most of the kinswomen with her. The strongest ones, at least. She left four with enough power to make a gateway together, but the attack. An assassin killed two of them before the other two could stop him. Alone, the two aren't strong enough to send for help. They're using their strength to heal."
"Blood and bloody ashes," Talmanis said, though he felt a stab of hope as he said it. Perhaps these women could not make a gateway, but they might be able to heal his wound.
"You should lead the refugees out of the city, Gaibon. My men hold the southern gate."
"Excellent,"
Gaibon said, straightening.
"But you will have to lead the refugees. I must defend the palace."
Talmanis raised an eyebrow at him. He didn't take orders from Gaibon. The band had its own command structure and reported only to the Queen. Matt had made that clear when accepting the contract. Unfortunately, Gaibon didn't take orders from Talmanis either. Talmanis took a deep breath, but then wavered, dizzy. Melton grabbed his arm to keep him from toppling over. Light, but it hurt. Couldn't his side just do the decent thing and grow numb? Blood and bloody ashes. He needed to get to those kinswomen. Talmanis said hopefully,
"Those two women who can heal?"
"I have sent for them already," Gaibon said. "As soon as we saw this force here."
Well, that was something.
"I do mean to stay here," Gaibon warned. "I won't abandon this post."
"Why? The city is lost, man."
"The Queen ordered us to send regular reports through gateways," Gaibon said. "Eventually she's going to wonder why we haven't sent a messenger. She will send a channeler to see why we haven't reported, and that messenger will arrive at the palace's traveling grounds. It—" "My lord!" a voice called. "My lord Talmanis!"
Gaibon cut off, and Talmanis turned to find Filger, one of the scouts, scrambling up the bloodied cobbles of the hillside toward him. Filger was a lean man, with thinning hair and a couple of days' worth of scruff, and the sight of him filled Talmanis with dread. Filger was one of those they'd left guarding the city gate below.
"My lord," Filger said, panting, "the Trollocs have taken the city walls. They're packing the ramparts, loosing arrows or spears at anyone who draws too close. Lieutenant Sandeep sent me to bring you word."
"Blood and ashes. What of the gate?"
"We're holding," Filger said. "For now."
"Gaibon,"
Talmanis said, turning back.
"Show some mercy, man. Someone needs to defend that gate. Please take the refugees out and reinforce my men. That gate will be our only method of retreat from the city."
"But the Queen's messenger—"
"The Queen will figure out what bloody happened once she thinks to look here. Look about you. Trying to defend the palace is madness. You don't have a city any longer, but a pyre."
Gaibon's face was conflicted.
his lips a tight line.
"You know I'm right,"
Talmanis said, his face twisted in pain.
"The best thing you can do is reinforce my men at the southern gate to hold it open for as many refugees as can reach it."
"Perhaps,"
Gibbon said.
"But to let the palace burn?"
"You can make it worth something," Talmanis said. "What if you left some soldiers to fight at the palace? Have them hold off the Trollocs as long as they can. That will draw the Trollocs away from the people escaping out this way. When they can hold no longer, your soldiers can escape the palace grounds on the far side, and hopefully make their way around to the southern gate."
"A good plan,"
Gibbon said grudgingly.
"I will do as you suggest. But what of you?"
"I have to get to the dragons," Talmanis said. "We can't let them fall to the shadow. They're in a warehouse near the edge of the inner city. The queen wanted them kept out of sight, away from the mercenary bands outside. I have to find them. If possible, retrieve them. If not, destroy them."
"Very well,"
Gibbon said, turning away, looking frustrated as he accepted the inevitable.
"My men will do as you suggest. Half will lead the refugees out, then help your soldiers hold the southern gate. The other half will hold the palace a little longer, then withdraw. But I'm coming with you."
"Do we really need so many lamps in here?" the Aes Sedai demanded from her stool at the back of the room. It might as well have been a throne. "Think of the oil you're wasting."
"We need the lamps," Andril grunted.
Night rain pelted the window, but he ignored it, trying to focus on the leather he was sewing. It would be a saddle. At the moment, he was working on the girth that would go around the horse's belly. He poked holes into the leather in a double row, letting the work calm him. The stitching chisel he used made diamond-shaped holes. He could use the mallet on them for speed if he wanted, but right now he liked the feel of pressing the holes without it. He picked up his stitch mark wheel, measuring off the locations for the next stitches, then worked another of the holes. You had to line the flat sides of the diamonds toward one another for holes like this, so that when the leather pulled, it didn't pull on the flats. The neat stitches would keep the saddle in good shape over the years. The rows needed to be close enough together to reinforce one another, but not so close that there was danger of them ripping into one another. Staggering the holes helped. Little things. You just had to make sure the little things were done right, and his fingers slipped, and he punched a hole with the diamond pointing the wrong way. Two of the holes ripped into one another at the motion. He nearly tossed the entire thing across the room in frustration. That was the fifth time tonight.
"Light," he thought, pressing his hands on the table. "What's happened to my self-control?"
He could answer that question with ease, unfortunately.
"The Black Tower is what happened."
He felt like a multi-legged Nachi trapped in a dried-up tidal pool, waiting desperately for the water to return while watching a group of children work their way down the beach with buckets, gathering up everything that looked tasty. He breathed in and out, then picked up the leather. This would be the shoddiest piece he'd done in years, but he would finish it. Leaving something unfinished was nearly as bad as messing up the details.
"Curious," said the Aes Sedai.
Her name was Pivara, of the Red Aja. He could feel her eyes on his back.
"A red. Well, common destinations made for unusual shipmates, as the old Tyran saying went. Perhaps he should use the Saldaean proverb instead. If his sword is at your enemy's throat, don't waste time remembering when it was at yours."
"So," Pivara said, "you were telling me about your life prior to coming to the Black Tower?"
"I don't believe that I was," Andril said, beginning to sew. "Why? What did you want to know?"
"I'm simply curious. Were you one of those who came here on his own to be tested? Or were you one of those they found while out hunting?"
He pulled the thread tight.
"I came on my own, as I believe Evan told you yesterday when you asked him about me."
"She said. I'm being monitored, I see."
He turned toward her, lowering the leather.
Is that something they teach you?
What? Vibara asked innocently.
To twist a conversation about. There you sit, all but accusing me of spying on you, and you were the one interrogating my friends about me.
I want to know what my resources are.
You want to know why a man would choose to come to the Black Tower? To learn to channel the One Power?
She didn't answer. He could see her deciding upon a response that would not run afoul of the three oaths. Speaking with an Aes Sedai was like trying to follow a green snake as it slipped through damp grass.
Yes, she said.
He blinked in surprise.
Yes, I want to know, she continued. We're allies, whether either of us desires it or not. I want to know what kind of person I've slipped into bed with.
She eyed him. Figuratively speaking, of course. He took a deep breath, forcing himself to become calm. He hated talking with Aes Sedai, with them twisting everything about. That, mixed with the tension of the night and the inability to get this saddle right.
He would be calm, light burn him.
We should practice making a circle, Vibara said. It will be an advantage to us, albeit a small one against Taim's men, should they come for us.
Andral put his dislike of the woman from his mind. He had other things to worry about, and forced himself to think objectively.
A circle.
Do you not know what one is?
Afraid not.
She pursed her lips.
Sometimes I forget how ignorant all of you are.
She paused, as if realizing she'd said too much.
All men are ignorant, Aes Sedai, Andral said. The topics of our ignorance may change, but the nature of the world is that no man may know everything.
That didn't seem to be the answer she'd been expecting either. Those hard eyes studied him. She didn't like men who could channel. Most people didn't. But with her it was more. She had spent her life hunting down men like Andral.
A circle, Vibara said, is created when women and men join their strength in the One Power together. It must be done in a specific way.
The Mahir will know about it then.
Men require women to form a circle, Vibara said. In fact, a circle must contain more women than men, except in very limited cases.
One woman and man can link, as can one woman and two men, as can two women and two men.
So the largest we could create is a circle of three, with me and two of you. Still, it could be of use to us.
I'll find you two of the others to practice with, Andral said. Among those I trust, I'd say that Nelam is the strongest. Emaran is very powerful, too, and I don't think he's yet reached the height of his strength. Same for Jonath.
They are the strongest? Vibara asked. Not yourself?
No, he said, returning to his work.
That rain picked up again outside, and chill air slipped under the door. One of the room's lamps was burning low nearby, letting shadows into the room. He watched the darkness uncomfortably.
I find that hard to believe, Master Andral, she said. They all look to you.
Believe what you wish, Aes Sedai. I'm weakest among them. Perhaps the weakest man in the Black Tower.
This quieted her, and Andral rose to refill that dwindling lamp. As he sat back down, a rap on the door announced the entrance of Emaran and Canler. Although both were wet from the rain, they were nearly as opposite as men could be. One was tall, refined, and careful, the other crotchety and prone to gossip. They had found common ground somewhere and seemed to enjoy one another's company.
Well? Andral asked.
It might work,
Emaran said, taking off his rain-soaked coat and hanging it on a hook beside the door. He wore clothing underneath embroidered after the Tyran style.
It would need to be a powerful rainstorm. The guards watch carefully.
I feel like the prize bull at a fair, Candler grumbled, stomping some of the mud off his boots after hanging up his coat. Everywhere we go, Taim's favored watch us from the corners of their eyes. Blood and ashes, Andril. They know. They know we're going to try running.
Did you find any weak points? Pivara asked, leaning forward. Someplace where the walls are less well guarded?
It appears to depend upon the guards chosen, Pivara Sedai, Imoran said, nodding to her.
I suppose that it would. Have I mentioned how intriguing I find it that the one of you who treats me with the most respect is a tyrant?
Being polite to a person is not a sign of respect for them, Pivara Sedai, Imoran said. It is merely a sign of a good upbringing and a balanced nature.
Andril smiled. Imoran was an absolute wonder with insults. Half the time the person didn't figure out that he'd been mocked until they'd parted ways. Pivara's mouth pursed.
Well then, we watch the rotation of guards.
When the next storm arrives, we will use it as cover and escape over the wall near the guards we think are less observant. The two men turned to Andril, who caught himself watching the corner of the room where the shadow fell from a table. Was it growing larger? Reaching toward him.
I don't like leaving men behind, he said, forcing himself to look away from the corner. There are dozens upon dozens of men and boys here who aren't yet under Taim's control. We can't possibly lead all of them out without drawing attention. If we leave them, we risk...
He couldn't say it. They didn't know what was happening, not really. People were changing. Once trustworthy allies became enemies overnight. They looked like the same people, yet different at the same time. Different behind the eyes. Andril shivered.
The women sent by the rebel Aes Sedai are still outside the gates, Pivara said.
They had been camped out there for a time, claiming the Dragon Reborn had promised them warders. Taim had yet to let any of them in.
If we can reach them, we can storm the tower and rescue those left behind. Will it really be that easy?
Imoran asked.
Taim will have an entire village of hostages. A lot of the men brought their families.
Candler nodded. His family was one of those. He wouldn't willingly leave them.
Beyond that, Andril said softly, turning on his stool to face Pivara, do you honestly think the Aes Sedai can win here?
Many of them have decades, some centuries, of experience.
How much of that was spent fighting?
Pivara did not answer.
There are hundreds of men who can channel in here, Aes Sedai, Andril continued. Each one has been trained at length. To be a weapon. We don't learn about politics or history. We don't study how to influence nations. We learn to kill. Every man and boy here is pushed to the edges of his capacity, forced to stretch and grow, gain more power, destroy. And a lot of them are insane. Can your Aes Sedai fight that? Particularly when many of the men we trust, the very men we're trying to save, will likely fight alongside Taim's men if they see the Aes Sedai trying to invade?
Your arguments are not without merit, Pivara said.
Just like a queen, he thought, unwillingly impressed at her poise.
But surely we need to send information out, Pivara continued. An all-out assault may be unwise, but sitting here until we are all taken, one at a time... I do believe it would be wise to send someone, Imoran said. We need to warn the Lord Dragon.
The Lord Dragon, Candler said with a snort, taking a seat by the wall. He's abandoned us, Imoran. We're nothing to him. It...
The Dragon Reborn carries the world on his shoulders, Candler,
Andril said softly, catching Candler up short.
I don't know why he's left us here. But I'd prefer to assume it's because he thinks we can handle ourselves.
Andril fingered the straps of leather, then stood up.
This is our time of proving the test of the Black Tower. If we have to run to the Aes Sedai to protect us from our own, we subject ourselves to their authority. If we have to run to the Lord Dragon, then we will be nothing once he is gone.
There can be no reconciliation with Taim now, Imaran said. We all know what he is doing.
Andril didn't look at Babara. She had explained what she suspected was happening, and she, despite years of training at keeping her emotions in check, had not been able to quiet the fear in her voice as she spoke of it. 13 Murdral and 13 channelers together in a horrifying rite could turn any channeler to the shadow, against his will.
What he does is pure, undiluted evil, Pivara said. There is no longer a division between the men who follow one leader and those who follow another. This is the Dark One's work, Andril. The Black Tower has fallen under the shadow. You must accept that.
The Black Tower is a dream, he said, meeting her eyes. A shelter for men who can channel. A place of our own, where men need not fear or run or be hated. I will not surrender that to Taim. I will not.
The room fell silent, save for the sounds of rain on the windows. Imaran began to nod, and Candler stood up, taking Andril by the arm.
You're right, Candler said. Burn me if you ain't right, Andril. But what can we do? We're weak, outnumbered.
Imaran, Andril said. Did you ever hear about the Nox Rebellion?
Indeed. It caused quite a stir, even outside of Mirandi.
Bloody Mirandians, Candler spat. They'll steal your coat off your back and beat you bloody if you don't offer your shoes, too.
Imaran raised an eyebrow.
Nox was well outside Lugard, Candler, Andril said. I think you'd find the people there not dissimilar to Andorans. The rebellion happened about, 10 years back now.
A group of farmers overthrew their lord, Imaran said. He deserved it, by all accounts. Desartan was a horrid person, particularly to those beneath him. He had a force of soldiers, one of the largest outside of Lugard, and was looking like he'd set up his own little kingdom. There wasn't a thing the king could do about it.
And Desartan was overthrown? Candler asked. By simple men and women who had had too much of his brutality, Andril said. In the end, many of the mercenaries who had been his cronies stood with us. Though he'd seemed so strong, his rotten core led to his downfall. It seems bad here, but most of Taim's men are not loyal to him. Men like him don't inspire loyalty. They'll collect cronies, others who hope to share in the power or wealth. We can and will find a way to overthrow him.
The others nodded, though Pivara simply watched him with pursed lips. Andril couldn't help feeling a bit of the fool. He didn't think the others should be looking to him instead of someone distinguished like Imaran, or someone powerful like Nalam. From the corner of his eye, he saw the shadows underneath the table lengthen, reaching for him. He set his jaw. They wouldn't dare take him with so many people around, would they? If the shadows were going to consume him, they'd wait until he was alone, trying to sleep. Nights terrified him.
They're coming when I don't hold to Sayadin now, he thought. Burn me, the source was cleansed. I'm not supposed to be losing more of my wits.
He gripped the seat of his stool until the terror retreated, the darkness withdrawing. Candler, looking uncharacteristically cheerful, said he was going to fetch them something to drink. He wandered toward the kitchen, but nobody was supposed to go about alone, so he hesitated.
I suppose I could use a drink as well, Pivara said with a sigh, joining him.
Andril sat down to continue his work. As he did, Imaran pulled over a stool, settling down beside him. He did so nonchalantly, as if merely looking for a good place to relax and wanting a view out the window. Imaran, however, wasn't the type to do things without several motivations.
"You fought in the Nox Rebellion?" Imaran said softly.
"Did I say that?"
Andral resumed his work on the leather.
"You said that when the mercenaries switched sides, they fought with you. You used the word us to refer to the rebels."
Andral hesitated.
"Burn me. I really need to watch myself."
If Imaran had noticed, Bavara would have as well.
"I was just passing through," Andral said, "and was caught up in something unanticipated."
"You have a strange and varied past, my friend," Imaran said. "The more I learn of it, the more curious I become."
"I wouldn't say that I'm the only one with an interesting past," Andral said softly. "Lord Elgaron of House Pendalon?"
Imaran pulled back, eyes widening.
"How did you know?"
"Fanshir had a book of Tyran noble lines," Andral said, mentioning one of the Ashaman soldiers who had been a scholar before coming to the tower. "It included a curious notation. A house troubled by a history of men with an unmentionable problem, the most recent one having shamed the house not a few dozen years ago."
"I see. Well, I suppose that it is not too much of a surprise that I am a nobleman."
"One who has experience with Aes Sedai," Andral continued, "and who treats them with respect, despite, or because of, what they did for his family. A Tyran nobleman who does this, mind you. One who does not mind serving beneath what you would term farm boys, and who sympathizes with citizen rebels. If I might say, my friend, that is not a prevalent attitude among your countrymen. I wouldn't hesitate to guess you've had an interesting past of your own."
Imaran smiled.
"Point conceded. You would be wonderful at the game of houses, Andral."
"I wouldn't say that," Andral said with a grimace. "Last time I tried my hand at it, I almost..."
He stopped.
"What?"
"I'd rather not say,"
Andral said, face flushing. He was not going to explain that period of his life. "Light people will think I'm as much a tailspinner as Nalam if I continue on like this."
Imaran turned to watch the rain hitting the window. "The Nox Rebellion succeeded for only a short time, if I remember correctly. Within 2 years, the noble line had re-established itself, and the dissenters were driven out or executed."
"Yes," Andral said softly.
"So we do a better job of it here," Imaran said, turning to him. "I'm your man, Andral. We all are."
"No," Andral said. "We are the Black Tower's men. I'll lead you, if I must. But this isn't about me or about you or any of us individually. I am only in charge until Loghain returns."
"If he ever returns," Andral thought. "Gateways into the Black Tower don't work any longer. Is he trying to return but finds himself locked out?" "Very well," Imaran said. "What do we do?"
Thunder crashed outside.
"Let me think," Andral said, picking up his piece of leather and his tools. "Give me 1 hour.
"I'm sorry,"
Jessamine said softly, kneeling beside Talmanis.
"There is nothing I can do. This wound is too far along for my skill."
Talmanis nodded, replacing the bandage. The skin all along his side had turned black as if from terrible frostbite. The kinswoman frowned at him. She was a youthful-looking woman with golden hair, though with channelers, ages could be very deceptive.
"I'm amazed you can still walk."
"I'm not certain it could be defined as walking," Talmanis said, limping back toward the soldiers.
He could still gimp along on his own, mostly, but the dizzy moments came more and more frequently now. Gaibon was arguing with Denil, who kept pointing at his map and gesturing. There was such a haze of smoke in the air that many of the men had tied kerchiefs to their faces. They looked like a band of bloody Aiel.
"Even the Trollocs are pulling out of that quarter," Gibbon insisted. "There's too much fire."
"The Trollocs are pulling back to the walls all through the city," Denel replied. "They're going to let the city burn all night. The only sector not burning is the one where the Waygate is. They knocked down all the buildings there to create a firewall."
"They used the One Power," Jessamine said from behind Talmanis. "I felt it. Black Sisters, I would not suggest going in that direction."
Jessamine was the only kinswoman remaining. The other had fallen. Jessamine wasn't powerful enough to create a gateway, but neither was she useless. Talmanis had watched her burn 6 Trollocs that had broken through his line. He'd spent that skirmish sitting back, overcome by the pain. Fortunately, Jessamine had given him some herbs to chew. They made his head feel fuzzier, but made the pain manageable. It felt as if his body were in a vice, being smashed slowly, but at least he could stay on his feet.
"We take the quickest route," Talmanis said. "The quarter that isn't burning is too close to the dragons. I won't risk the Shadow Spawn discovering Aludra and her weapons."
"Assuming they haven't already." Gibbon glared at him, but this was the band's operation. Gibbon was welcome, but he wasn't part of their command structure. Talmanis's force continued through the dark city, wary of ambushes. Though they knew the approximate location of the warehouse, getting there was problematic. Many large streets were blocked by wreckage, fire, or the enemy. His force had to crawl through alleyways and lanes so twisted that even Gibbon and the others from Camelin had difficulty following their intended direction. Their path skirted portions of the city that burned with a heat so strong it was probably melting cobblestones. Talmanis stared at these flames until his eyes felt dry, then led his men in further detours. Inch by inch, they approached Aludra's warehouse. Twice they encountered Trollocs prowling for refugees to kill. They finished these off, the remaining crossbowmen felling over half of each group before they had time to respond. Talmanis stood to watch, but did not trust himself to fight any longer. That wound had left him too weak. Light, why had he left his horse behind? Fool move, that. Well, the Trollocs would have chased it off anyway.
"My thoughts are starting to go in circles."
He pointed with his sword down a crossing alley. The scouts scurried on ahead and looked in both directions before giving the all clear.
"I can barely think. Not much longer now before the darkness takes me."
He would see the dragons protected first. He had to. Talmanis stumbled out of the alley onto a familiar street. They were close. On one side of the street, the structures burned. The statues there looked like poor souls trapped in the flames. The fires raged around them, their white marble slowly becoming overcome with black. The other side of the street was silent, nothing there burning. Shadows thrown by the statues danced and played, like revelers watching their enemies burn. The air smelled oppressively of smoke. Those shadows and the burning statues seemed to move to Talmanis's fuzzy mind. Dancing creatures of shadow, dying beauties consumed by a sickness. Upon the skin, darkening it, feasting upon it, killing the soul.
"We're close now," Talmanis said.
He pushed himself forward into a shambling run. He couldn't afford to slow them down. If that fire reaches the warehouse. They arrived at a burned-out patch of ground. The fire had been here and gone, apparently. A large wooden warehouse had stood here once, but it had fallen in. Now the timbers only smoldered, and were heaped with rubble and half-burnt Trolloc corpses. The men gathered around him silent. The only sound was that of crackling flames. Cold sweat dripped down Talmanis's face.
"We were too late," Melton whispered. "They took them, didn't they? The dragons would have made explosions if they'd burned. The Shadowspawn arrived, took the dragons and burned the place down."
Around Talmanis, exhausted members of the band sank down to their knees.
I'm sorry, Matt, Talmanis thought. We tried. We...
A sudden sound, like thunder, cracked through the city. It shook Talmanis to his bones, and the men looked up.
Light, Gaibon said. The Shadowspawn are using the dragons?
Maybe not, Talmanis said.
Strength surged through him, and he broke into a run again. His men filled in around him. Each footfall sent a jolt of agony up his side. He passed down the street with the statues, encircled in flames, to his right, cold stillness to his left.
Boom!
Those explosions didn't sound loud enough to be dragons. Dared he hope for an Aes Sedai? Jessamine seemed to have perked up at the sounds and was running in her skirts alongside the men. The group barreled around a corner two streets from the warehouse and came up on the back ranks of a snarling force of Shadowspawn. Talmanis bellowed with a startling ferocity and raised his sword in two hands. The fire of his wound had spread through his entire body. Even his fingers burned with it. He felt as if he'd become one of those statues, consigned to burn with the city. He beheaded a Trolloc before it knew he was there, then threw himself at the next creature in line. It drew back with an almost liquid grace, turning a face on him that had no eyes, a cloak that did not stir in the wind. Pale lips drew back in a snarl. Talmanis found himself laughing. Why not? And men said he didn't have a sense of humor. Talmanis moved into apple blossoms in the wind, striking forward wildly with a strength and fury to match the fire that was killing him. The Myrdrel obviously had him at a disadvantage. At his best, Talmanis would have needed help fighting one. The thing moved like a shadow, flowing from one form to the next, its terrible blade darting toward Talmanis. It obviously felt it only needed to nick him. It scored a hit on his cheek, the tip of its sword catching on his skin there and slicing a neat ribbon through the flesh.